The following may contain offensive language, adult humor, and/or content that some viewers may find offensive. The views and opinions expressed by any one speaker does not explicitly or necessarily reflect or represent those of Mark Rattledge or W2M Network. Please listen with caution, or don't listen at all.
Welcome to On Trial, starring Mark Rattledge, also starring Sean Comer. Hope you're ready, Hollywood, because you're on trial.
All rise. Court is now in session on this special Thanksgiving edition of On Trial. The Honorable Harry T. Stone presiding. And I, tonight, am your prosecuting attorney, Mr. Mark Rattledge, your mandated reporter, and frankly, I'm stuffed with turkey. And tonight on the docket is Sleepy Hollow. Sleepy Hollow is a 1999 gothic supernatural horror film directed by Hollywood's greatest monster, Tim Burton. It is a film adaptation loosely based on Washington Irving's 1820 short story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, or if you're a child, the Disney cartoon. And it stars Tim Burton's hetero life mate, Johnny Depp, and Christina Ricci with Miranda Richardson, Michael Gambone, Casper Van Dien, Christopher Lee from Where the Culture Comes From, and Jeffrey Jones in supporting roles. So Jeffrey Jones, who you may remember from Howard the Duck. Duck boobs, woo! The plot follows a constable, Ichabod Crane, Johnny Depp, sent from New York to investigate a series of murders in the village of Sleepy Hollow by a mysterious headless horseman. And straight from his role as sexy Beetlejuice, ladies and gentlemen, from Freaky Pictures, Dorian Price. How do you do, sir?
Not too bad. How are you doing today?
I can't complain. I worked today. Everyone else was off and enjoying their family time. I was trying to make that money because we need money, Dorian. You understand?
Yeah, I technically worked this morning, so I don't understand how you feel completely. I wasn't happy about it either, but I did end up making food. But everybody who's out there, happy Thanksgiving. Hopefully you're watching this and not passed out from turkey, which I'm now hearing is a urban myth. But on the off chance it's not, hopefully you're watching this and seeing and questioning what the hell did I do to my hair and my face this time.
You know, it's a time-honored tradition on the Rattledge and Broadcasting Network to do holiday-specific shows, especially for Thanksgiving. My son and I have done some holiday-related triple features around this time. We've done some alternative commentaries. Jesse and I used to do, or Robert Cooper and I used to do the Metal Hammer of Doom Turkey edition, where we would review a terrible metal album, you know, like Saint Anger by Metallica, or I just re-aired it this morning, Limp Bizkit's Greatest Hits, because we're going to take that cookie, Dorian, and shove it up your, if you're not careful. But this is not a turkey, and this isn't even really like a Thanksgiving-related movie. But it is Sleepy Hollow by Tim Burton, and this was not my idea of a good time. This was your pitch, sir. Why am I here? Why are we doing this?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's not a Thanksgiving movie, but it did come out in November of 1999. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this is that I had gotten to, when I started coming on the podcast, Alexis, who has been on the show, for those of you who watched a lot of times, sent me a whole bunch of old shows and suggested some old shows just so I could get the idea of how things were working. I ran across one that you guys did for They Live, John Carpenter's They Live, with Pat. I'm so sorry, sir, if you're watching. I can't remember your last name. But you know who you are.
Mr. Toxic Masculinity, Mr. Pat Mullen.
Yeah, the Toxic Masculinity Avenger. added you a title, dude. But no, so when I thought about movies I'd want to defend, this is one that is a personal favorite of mine. It is ironically the first R-rated horror film I was ever able to see. and watch at home. The people who raised me thought that a movie about a college professor that becomes a pimp was a totally fine film for me to watch. Dr. Detroit, for those of you who don't know that, that's Dan Aykroyd. That's a fun one. That was fine, but horror movies that are R-rated, oh no, that's wrong. You can't do that. So this movie was very important to me because I had already gotten into the horror elements of seeing Phantom of the Opera, like 1925 one, the 43 one, a lot of the Universal classic ones. And this movie being, again, loosely, and actually this is the first time I'm going to say this during this thing. This is the, we made it better than the original story movie.
It's fair.
Which I'll get to once we start, you know, trading fisticuffs. But they did make... this, since it was based on classic literature, the people who raised me didn't have really a leg to stand on. And by then I was already very Burton obsessed. He's also one of my heroes. My costume today is what I think is a very bad self-portrait would look like. So the reason
look like Beetlejuice, the triple X version of Beetlejuice.
Which sadly, I'm sure that exists. Do not Google it. Talking to you, audience. Spare yourselves. But no, this is one of my favorite Tim Burton films. And I figured of the two that I would want to defend of his thing, it was between this or Batman Returns. And I love you too much, Mark, to have us have to fight that one. And I love that one.
I've already done that one. We did the Burton Batmans years ago on Long Road to Ruin. So, but. You're not the first person who has wanted to relitigate some of the movies we did from the Long Road to Ruin era, and I have a hard and fast rule of no, go fuck yourself. I don't want to do it again.
I suffered through it once.
Yes. Boy, did I tear that movie to shreds. I want to talk about Tim Burton for a minute. I don't want to spend too long because I do want to get to the movie. I know you're like chomping at the bit to tell me how wonderful this movie is, and the most part I don't disagree with you. I watched it with my daughter and my son, and my daughter, who has a penchant for the gothic and the horror, really liked it. Like, it's hard to get my kids to... It's easy to get them to go to the movies because I go, get the fuck in the car, and they go, yes, Dad. Yes, Father. They call me Father. so it's easy to get them in the car and go see a movie. We go almost every week. It's a little harder to get them to sit down and watch a movie at home because they've got the TikTok, and they don't stop. So it's a little hard to kind of keep their interest in something that isn't anime. And we just happened to be home this past week. And I said, hey, I'm going to watch this movie while we're waiting for dinner to get made. And my daughter snuggled up next to me and she was like, oh, Tim Burton, gothic, horror, Johnny Depp. This looks great. And she sat and she watched the whole movie and she really loved it. So I don't have a strong prosecutory argument, but I do have some criticisms, as I always do. But I made it a halfway
to your daughter for liking the movie.
I will let her know that she has your approval. She'll be thrilled. I have joked about Tim Burton being a monster, and I do want to just spend a few minutes talking about Tim Burton because this movie it's got Tim Burton all over it. And not the least of which, you know, it's got Johnny Depp, who's in a bunch of his films, hence that joke that I made. But you know, Tim Burton, I'm a child of the 80s and 90s, and I grew up in my teenagerhood and 20s in the goth industrial culture. So I knew all the kids ever who liked Tim Burton. Tim Burton spoke to those kids. A lot of black, a lot of creepy imagery, a lot of wild, what's the dude's name from The Cure, hair.
Robert Smith.
Robert Smith, yes. It was Friday and he was in love, Dorian, don't you understand? So there was a lot of that.
Yeah, I am too. I can't give him too much shit.
People gravitated towards Tim Burton. And, you know, whether you liked his stuff or not, he definitely had... it's funny. This kind of goes to part of my craft review. I'm going to throw this at you. One of the things my daughter and I talked about, because she asked me what I thought of the movie when it was over, and I said, Tim Burton typically has a lot of sizzle, not a lot of steak. He's high on aesthetic. He's high on visual vision. He's high on the general look and feel of a film. But I don't know how much his movies have anything to say. I don't know beyond sort of set design and aesthetic if there's a tremendous amount of competency to his movies. I think he gets by on people like the look of it, but no one asks a lot of questions, and so no one stops to think, is this movie any good? And then he gets people like Johnny Depp, and Johnny Depp is an interesting actor. I don't know if he's always good, but he does a lot of fun things on camera that at first blush make people think he's a good actor. But when he's really just doing a Ministry of Silly Walks, or, you know, so funny. I love the story of him in Pirates of the Caribbean where he's like, I want to wear, you know, prosthetics and I want to have ugly teeth. And the studio's like, no, stupid. You're a handsome man. Stop ugling yourself up. And there was a story about that here too, where he wanted to look like how Ichabod Crane is described. And they're like, no, stupid. You're a handsome man. Like, stop ugling yourself. You stop ugling yourself up. So I threw a lot at you, and I want to get your response. What do you say in defense, since you love him so much, of Tim Burton?
Well, I'm going to start with what you said. His movies don't have a lot to say. And I can see that being a complaint. Here is my counter on that, is that we have gotten into a realm of filmmaking and movie making. We're rarely using film form, where every story has to say something. It has to preach. It has to have this golden meeting that we take home. One of the things that I think that Tim Burton and I kind of put Guillermo del Toro in the same box, simply because they are both very highly visual storytellers that very much love the twisted fairy tales, is what's wonderful about this film and a lot of other Burton films is they are the epitome of filmmaking, in my opinion, which is escapism. It's, we're going to take you on a journey. We're going to, you know, we're not going to learn some deep message. We're not going to have and I love this filmmaker too. We're not going to have a Chris Nolan sermon for it, you know, which again, is one of my, since we were talking about Batman earlier. Oh, thank you, Shay. Hi, Shay.
Shay says making pretty people ugly is my greatest goal in life. That's a laudable goal there, sweetie. Thank you for watching, Shay.
Keep going, Dorian. Although I don't know if you made me ugly, Shay. You just kind of made me look like a really glam goth rocker, which I'm totally okay with. Never gonna happen.
Thursday. It's Thursday, and Dorian's in love. I don't care if Monday's blue. Sorry. Go on.
Yeah, then I gotta get like really close to the camera, start doing like weird. Yeah, I've watched the music videos that came out eons before I was born. Shut up. But no, coming back to my thing is. Burton, one of the things Burton does well, and I'm the first to say, I mean, I would love to meet the man. I'd love to work with him. He is one of my heroes. He inspired me. He's one of the inspirations of becoming a filmmaker. One of the not all of his films are gold. They're not all perfect, but they all are in some way entertaining. And it isn't about learning necessarily a lesson. It's not about some great deeper meaning. It's a fun escapism ride. We're going to go into a world that's not quite like ours. It's just a little different. And we're going to have a good time for an hour and a half. You get to escape all the hell that's going on outside the theater doors. And we're going to transport you to this world. Sit back, have fun, hopefully have some laughs, a few screams. And we did our job.
Here's the only counter I have to that. And then we can move on to the film itself. Mm-hmm. I don't want to live in a world without Tim Burton. I think Tim Burton has a very unique... style that the film world would sorely miss him if he were gone. And I don't certainly want to take away a director, a creator who has brought so many people such joy. Obviously, he speaks to a lot of people. He's very successful. And that's really not my issue. My issue is everyone takes the wrong lessons from Tim Burton, because you're not wrong. And that's why I can't really argue with your defense as such when you're saying it's not that he's Scorsese. It's not that he's, you know, speaking to the nature of man as such. He is creating this fantasy world for us to escape to, and that is sometimes all film needs to be, is a place for you to go to get out of the humdrum of your life. And I understand that. The problem is everyone then kind of looks at Tim Burton and goes, I want to do that too. And very few people are as talented as him that they can get away with it. So what ends up happening is you end up having a lot of imitation that is shallow, pedantic, and frankly uninteresting. And that's, I kind of look back at him and go, what fresh hell hath thou wrought, Tim Burton? You did a nice thing, but then 20 other people tried to do what you did, and they're not nearly as good. And then we get this like swath of film that's just garbage. And I look back and I go, this is your fault, Tim Burton. You caused this.
Well, a brief objection. Yes, a very brief objection here is that every filmmaker, and hopefully myself as well, wants to inspire the next generation to get behind, or the not even next generation. Like, you're a little bit older than I am, but only by a little bit. So it's like if you had never met me on this podcast and I had done films and my visual style inspired you to be like, you know what, I'm getting behind that camera, then great. That's the dream, is that we all find that creative outlet. Now, I agree that a lot of people wanted to become Tim Burton copycats. When I was a little child and doing video movies in my backyard, trust me, I was doing the same thing. Right. Although I was 5 at the time, so there's a little bit of an excuse. But I think, and it's the same thing with any director. It happens with Chris Nolan. It happened with Stanley Kubrick. You know, actually with Chris Nolan kind of did try to copy Stanley Kubrick. So I object to the fact that it's Tim Burton's fault. I think that he is such a unique and brilliant artist that flame kind of brings all the moths, and only a few of those moths are black and cool.
Okay. God, I'll tell you, you know, Tim Burton brought us Edward Scissorhands, a movie I haven't actually never seen, but I've never seen it.
I would deeply recommend it. I know it's not what we're talking about, and I'm not going to go into why you should go see it, but I deeply recommend it. It is a beautiful retelling. I'd like that stricken from the record, please. Record, is someone supposed to be writing this down?
I love that you're playing into the gimmick. This is great. This is so much fun for me.
You're good. I actually had a whole bunch of notes until I went back and watched an old On Trial, and I was like, okay, I need to like take this down like 15 notches.
Dorian walks in with like charts and graphs, like, and this represents 50% of the population, and this represents 50% of the population. Like, all right, easy does it. It's a podcast.
We're sitting here. We're not getting paid for this. Calm your shit. Edward Scissorhands is an amalgamation of a beautiful, dark, romantic fairy tale, and it is done very, very well. It has elements of Frankenstein in it, and many other things. It's also one of Vincent Price's last performances, and even of what little he is, he's fantastic in it. But yes, it's a great film. Go watch it. I mean, not right now because we're doing that.
Thanks. Absolutely. I'm going to go right into, I'm going to pitch you over to do the production notes for Sleepy Hollow. But I think what my hesitation, and it's not that you made bad arguments, you made very good arguments. And, you know, I'm more or less convinced by what you're saying, but I think my only holdout is you get a guy like who makes an Edward Scissorhands, and then 20 other people try to make Edward Scissorhands, and they don't know why Edward Scissorhands is resonating with people, and instead they make a guy running around with scissors. And it's like, come and that pains me, Dorian. You know, it's the old we talk about this on Damn You Hollywood. It's like, it's not that you tilted the camera, but why do you tilt the camera? You know, if you're going to make the sort of gothic horror, gothic love stories, know why they're like, know you're the audience it's speaking to, know why it's resonating with them, not do a copy of what you already saw that work, because this is how we get movies that miss the point. And that's my great frustration.
And I absolutely agree with you on that. I don't feel like it's Tim's fault or this movie's fault, but it is the, for every action, there was an equal and opposite reaction. And in the culture we live in, it's inevitable, especially with
film. So tell me about Sleepy Hollow. How do we get this movie made?
Okay, Sleepy Hollow starts off, and I'm going to give me just a second. I want to pull up some notes because I don't want to screw up some of these people's names because they're all professional people and I don't want to be a dick. So 1993, Kevin Yeager, who is a makeup effects designer, he had started directing episodes of Tales from the Crypt. And he'd also been a very big fan when he was a child of the Washington Irving short story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. So he wants to turn it into a feature film. He wants to make the full movie. So he talks to Andrew Kevin Walker, who has written a whole bunch of movies, and going into them would take far too much time. But they worked in the film treatments, and they started changing some things right off the bat. And this is where we kind of start talking about some of the funny stories about this film. And I apologize, folks. I'm not trying to get M. Night Shyamalan close to the camera. I'm just setting the iPad down so I don't let it fall. For those of you who haven't read the Washington Irving short story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, it is, you know what? It's trash. It is, when you put it standing next to even a short story, if you put it next to some of the other great writing that was coming out at that time in short story form, it is bottom of the barrel. I am still investigating why it became such a classic. Now, again, this is just my opinion. If you're out there,
my almost 13-year-old daughter asked me as we were watching this movie, like, this has to be written by Edgar Allan Poe, right? Because he's the only ever Gothic writer ever. He's like, this is Edgar Allan Poe, right?
Mary Shelley, first of all.
Yes, somewhere out there, Mary Shelley just, what the fuck he was? No, she's almost 13. She doesn't know. But she's sitting there watching this movie, and she was just like, this is totally Edgar Allan Poe, right? And I'm like, you know what? I don't even know. And I had to look it up. I'm like, no, there's clearly, yeah, there's another person out there doing this sort of thing, Washington Irving.
And it's just very boring. And first time that this story gets made into any sort of a visual telling that I found, at least that still exists and that I could really get any hands on, is obviously the 60s Bing Crosby narrated Disney version of it, which is basically
someone I'm most familiar with.
Ichabod Crane is a schoolmaster who apparently is a gold digging douchebag, but Brom, who is the guy who has decided that this girl, the main girl that Ichabod, the schoolmaster in the story, is after, is his girl, is equal amounts of douche. He just has more muscle. So the idea of the story is that Ichabod's out riding one night. He gets chased by this headless horseman, and it's never seen from again. And we find a smashed pumpkin and Ichabod's hat, but nothing else. So we assume that the horseman got him. And we're kind of led to believe that just simply because of the time period that it's written in, is the douchebag and his friends, which is chase down Ichabod to get him out of town because that's my bitch and you better back off because I got muscles. So again, another reason why all jocks in horror movies should die horrible deaths, and just to encourage real life jocks to be like, let's stop fucking with the skinny kids. They're maniacal. Let's do something else. But actually, the scene of them screwing with Ichabod is actually in this Tim Burton film. But coming back to, it's 1993. Kevin Yeager is working on the script treatment, and they just don't trust basically his directing style. They don't think that he's a big enough name to draw to this. But at the time, Tim Burton is technically still ruling the world. His reign starts in 1989, like 88's Beetlejuice really gets him off the, and previously, obviously, Pee-wee's Playhouse gets his name out there, but 1989 Batman cements it. This is our new auteur filmmaker. The 90s are ups and downs with great films, obviously, like Ed Wood, biopic of the person of the same name.
Covered here for Pride Month, right here in the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network this past year. Fantastic movie, but Ed Wood is excellent.
And also, I think it won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for Martin Landau as Bela Lugosi. And then we have Mars Attacks, which I enjoy the movie because, again, what I was saying earlier, it's a turn it on, switch your brain off, kick back, have fun. Don't worry about anything for an hour and a half.
We've been doing these director focuses on Triple Feature, Sean and I, and I might have to have you back to do a Tim Burton one, and right in the middle, Mars Attacks.
I'm there.
I love it. I think Mars Attacks is fantastic. It's so stupid.
It's so stupid and it's so fun, and this is where we get start getting into the brilliance that is Sleepy Hollow. Because I'm not going to talk too much about Mars Attacks. For those of you who don't know, it's based on a Topps card game that Tim Burton was a huge fan of. This brings us to Sleepy Hollow. Because again, 1990, late 1997, 98, and when they're in production for this, obviously Tim Burton is still the king. So the script treatment, Burton had very little to do with, obviously, because he doesn't really write most of his own stuff. So this movie, and the most important story to me about it, is this is a love letter. This is Tim Burton's love letter to his childhood. And what I mean by that is go back and watch this film after you're done here. Or pause the movie here, or pause this here in a second, go watch it and then come back. We'll be here. Well, maybe not that long, but you know, this is a love letter to the late 1950s and 60s Hammer horror films. Case in point, two big actors.
Just keep going.
I'm just going to do the rest of my rest of my argument in Mars voice.
That works for me.
Subtitle it later. But even some of the actors in this are Hammer alumni. First and foremost, obviously, Christopher Lee, most well-known for playing Dracula in several Hammer horror films. He also played the Frankenstein monster. He also played the Mummy. You know, he was a Hammer alum. Michael Goff, who we all know, or most of us who are Burton fans, know as Alfred from the 1989 Batman, follow-up Batman Returns, Batman Forever and Batman and Robin, was also a Hammer alum and had faced Christopher Lee in the first Hammer film, or first Hammer Dracula film, Horror of Dracula, 1958. So you can tell just by the casting alone that he was a huge Hammer fan. But the set design, it is this minimalistic but still grand, which is what Hammer was known for. The blood in this movie, the outrageous gore, it is a just short of sexting your girlfriend love letter to those movies and how much he loved them. And that is the most important thing, in my opinion, to remember about this movie as you go in, is that it is if you go back, if you watch any Hammer films, if you've seen any Hammer films that you haven't seen this one, watch it, because again, it is a love letter, and it is a beautifully crafted love letter. As we with the changes of the script are obviously numerous. It makes it much longer. There's more of a mystery involved in it that starts off very much as a whodunit and then becomes a supernatural whodunit. But the biggest change was obviously Ichabod Crane himself. Ichabod Crane in the original story is very long-nosed and very lanky. In fact, Batman creators Bob Kane and Bill Finger took the last name Crane for the character, Batman character of Scarecrow, because Scarecrow being so skinny and lanky. That was from Washington Irving's, they took directly from Washington Irving's story. But in this case, Ichabod Crane is not a schoolmaster. He is not long-nosed. He is the still very, very dapper and sweet, quiet, bad boy, Johnny Depp. In this
foppish.
Case, foppish. Yeah, we're getting there. But he is a police inspector who is a absolute coward and has a very weak stomach, and he faints a lot in this movie.
Oh, don't get ahead of me. Oi, do I have some things to say about that?
I do too. I'm ready. So this is kind of when everybody started to realize that Tim Burton and Johnny Depp were going to be a continual thing, because Edward Scissorhands, okay, he's still young, you know, he's still getting roles. Okay, fine. Ed Wood, okay, looks enough like the guy. That's fair. This was the one that's like, okay, this is going to be a thing for a while. And as much people give him, Lex H, it is, technically makeup to accentuate the lips and make them look more drawn. I was trying to go for a Tim Burton drawing look. So in a way, yes, you're right. I am wearing lipstick and proud. What was I saying? this is all planned by you, Mark, to send her in there to throw me off. but there are obviously a lot of changes to the script. And in this case, obviously, he's very foppish. He's very cowardly, which creates a good juxtaposition. Sorry, now I remember where I was going. People give the whole Tim Burton cast Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter and everything a lot of crap. But if you go back to the 40s as well, in the 50s, a director named John Ford, for one, was known for using the same crew and the same actors, which a lot of times included Western star John Wayne. And coming from a film student point of view, if you find a cast that is broad enough that they can tackle several characters and you know you can trust to get the performance you want out of them every time, it's not necessarily a bad thing. At the same time, I do disagree with, okay, every single leading role. Like, you couldn't put Johnny in the back of one of these. I mean, I love him too, man. I get it. But, you know.
Can I tell you how disappointed my daughter was that Christina Ricci was not Helena Bonham Carter? She was like, oh, it's a Tim Burton movie. It has to have, I'm like, she's almost 13. Even she knows. It has to have Johnny Depp. And she called her Beatrix because Harry Potter.
Bellatrix,
yeah. And I'm just like, nope, this is Christina Ricci. And she's like, dang it. Like, what was she not? What was she off that day? What, why?
Young Miss Radulich. Helena Bonham Carter and Tim Burton wouldn't meet for another three years on
preceded their getting together.
They met on Planet of the Apes, which
hey, another movie we did an on trial for.
Yeah, even I can't back him on that one. Even nope. I'm like, buddy.
That Sean and I had a fist fight over who was going to prosecute that one because that was the easy part.
You could have probably called Tim Burton and he would have prosecuted it. I'm sorry, guys. It sounded like a great idea. I love the movie.
Tim Burton, your Planet of the Apes is hanging out. Hide your shame.
Right.
All right. But, anything else before we move on?
I think that's about it. I'll just, again, wrap up with this is. Burton had said his term, because I don't think he technically coined it, but he gets the credit for it, the term reimagining.
Mm-hmm.
This is, in my opinion, one of the most perfect upgrades from a story, written story, to film. There have been others. Case in point, Stephen King's 1408. Short story is a mess. Movies, actually really good. This movie is 1,000 times, with all of its failings, because there is no such thing as a perfect movie. With all of its failings, this is an enjoyable, fun, gothic mystery, gothic horror story, which actually was going to start out when this is my last bit. One of the reasons Kevin Yeager was pushed from the director's chair is he wanted it to be a full-on slasher film. And they went, no. The 80s is long dead. Seen how slasher movies have done in the 90s? And you ask things, it's going to go better. Okay, you just go sit over there and do the makeup. Which is exactly what he did. He actually stayed on doing the makeup for the film. The only other... I'm trying to make sure I got my notes here. Sorry, there is a couple other things. Of Harry Potter fans, but Michael Gambon is the lead of the town. He's kind of the town leader. Most of you know him as Dumbledore. That's another one for you, young Miss Radulich, Harry Potter fan out there.
Oh, she recognized him. She recognized Dumbledore and the uncle.
Yes. The town provost is Uncle Vernon from Harry Potter. So it is very much a Harry Potter reunion. The town doctor is Ian McDiarmid. None other than Emperor Palpatine himself. I already talked about Michael Goff. I thought it was funny that you said Jeffrey Jones, who you'll remember from Howard the Duck, which, yes, I do. But he didn't go Beetlejuice. I was like, it's even a Burton.
Because fuck Beetlejuice. That's why. Howard the Duck, man.
I hate that movie so much. Tune in next time to watch Mark and Dorian fight over Howard the Duck.
My kids and I insisted we do a commentary track for Howard the Duck because I guess there was a conversation had at a dinner that I was not present for about duck boobs. And they went, what? So we did. Duck boobs. Woo. So we did the entire commentary track just so my kids could see duck boobs.
But yeah, the last notable member of the cast, obviously Christina Ricci, still very, very much in demand after her role as Wednesday Addams. She gets to be blonde here, which go blondes. I'm just saying, blondes are the best. Has nothing to do with the movie. That's just a personal addition. But one of the things that people miss is that Ray Park, who a lot of people really only know as Darth Maul, does all of the sword work stunts as the Headless Horseman. And he was filming his parts in this directly after he had finished his parts for Darth Maul in episode one, because both movies would come out the same year, just several months apart.
All right.
That's it.
So, before I make my opening remarks and prosecute this movie, let me say the plot. I'm not going to read the plot because I have found that it kills the podcast dead. But we have Johnny Depp, and he is living on the eve of the 19th century. It is the year of our Lord, 1799. And in colonial New York, they love the Jesus. They are fond of religion. And Johnny Depp's like, but science. And they're like, which? Like, all right, take it easy. No, Johnny Depp is like, hey, let's do some things that would help us solve crimes. It's sort of early forensic science. And they go, how about you go to upstate New York, Sleepy Hollow, and, you know, peddle your witchy wares there. And so he is exiled and sent to solve a series of murders happening in Sleepy Hollow. And much like The Crucible, there's a plausible explanation that this is being done to rob someone of their inheritance. But lo and behold, while that may have been the case, it is in fact being done by a supernatural being of sorts, the Headless Horseman. So the bulk of the movie is Johnny Depp as Ichabod Crane trying to solve these murders and little by little piecing together this investigation, finding clues, talking to people, discovering the horseman, being chased about, and eventually coming face to face. It's one of these deals where there is a human who has a thing and they're controlling the monster. And, you know, once they get rid of that person and the monster is satiated, the monster goes away peacefully. There's a backstory about who the Headless Horseman was. He was a Hessian who particularly
played by Hessian. A screaming Christopher Walken.
I'm going to get there in a moment. So it's played by Christopher Walken, who, if you'd only seen him in this role, you would think doesn't know how to act. He's got very pointy teeth. Anyway.
Lines.
Yeah, he sort of a Freddy Krueger type of deal where, you know, he is a spirit of bloody vengeance and he is taken out. And he is brought back as this monster. And then, you know, finally he is given back his head and then he goes off to live deliberately. Christina Ricci is allowed to have her fortune, and Ichabod Johnny Depp is look, my ways work. I am a, you know, and he goes back to New York, conquering hero. And there's Sleepy Hollow. It's a good movie. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed watching it with my daughter. Especially I enjoy it when she enjoys things as her father. But I did notice there was a couple of issues that the movie has that you just can't get around. First of all, if you want to get blackout drunk, take a drink every time someone faints in this movie. Every fucking scene. And here's where, like, I have to pick at Tim Burton, because I think Tim Burton, you know, yes, he collaborates, and it's collaboration that saves a lot of directors from their own self-indulgence. But sometimes I think, like, there's not enough people in the room to tell some of these people no. And so Tim Burton kind of is allowed to kind of get away with stuff that I think if another adult were in the room brave enough to say no, there'd be less of that sort of thing. And the fainting feels like it was a funny gag once or twice, but because Tim Burton doesn't know how to stop himself and it's like a child beating a drum. And this, I've seen this in his other movie. That's why I'm picking at this one, but I have seen this before with Tim Burton, where he doesn't know when to stop. He doesn't know when it's not funny anymore. And like an autistic person, he's like, just keeps doing it and doing it and doing it again, to the point where, like, my daughter and I were, this was not the effect you wanted. My daughter and I were laughing hysterically every time somebody fainted in this movie because it happened so many goddamn times. Like, even if you are going for a cheap laugh, you still only do it once or twice and then you're done with this. Move on. Like, like Johnny Depp's major characteristic, fainting. It irritated the shit out of me. I didn't mind the other foppish stuff about him. I thought it was a nice contrast, to be honest. I liked the idea that I'm a man of science, and I am a man of justice, and I want to solve this crime and bring justice to this town. And oh God, blood and falls over. It's different. I think it was an interesting way of handling it. It creates tension where there might not have been any. I like the fact that everyone's kind of in on it. So he is working uphill against forces that are trying to actively stop him. And they don't want more murders to happen, but they don't necessarily want him to find out why it's happening either.
They're not willing to reveal their secrets. So. Yeah.
So, but you know, like I said, the idea of him being sort of a man of science in a world of religion, I think creates good tension in an otherwise tensionless movie. I'm going to echo Christina Ricci's own criticism of this movie. Her character has no character. She is blonde in danger, and that's it. They spent so much time dealing with the men in this movie, they gave the female nothing.
I object and say that I think that the witch subplots that she had that would have tied her to Ichabod's mother, could have been more fleshed out and investigated, maybe make her a possible villain. But then we come back to the love letter to Hammer horror films. Sadly, there were very few female characters in Hammer horror films that weren't hot, pushing the boobs up, and in danger.
Right, but
the hair color just changed.
So the funny thing about the structure of this is I'm both an attorney and the judge, and overruled. Because an ode is nice. It should not be when your ode makes your movie less than it could be. That's not doing yourself any favors. That's still not good filmmaking. Like, I don't care if you're doing an, you know, like I might want to be doing an ode to blaxploitation films. I still have to make it good.
Oh yeah.
You know, I can't rest on, well, this is what they did in a Pam Grier movie once, so I did it too. Yes, but it sucked then and it sucks now.
When also the time period we're in of the late 90s are.
I'm not asking her to be Captain Marvel. I'm asking her to have a character.
Yes, I will agree with you completely on that her character is very weak and very much supposed to be the where goth girls at this point had always just been like, you know, Winona Ryder and Beetlejuice, the dark hair was like, hey, blondes can be goth and creepy too, you know.
Well, that's the thing, it's like she's a do-nothing princess.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I look at, you know, Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia. They give Princess Leia stuff to do. She has a very definable character. She's a damsel in distress. She has to be rescued by Luke Skywalker. But there's still, like, if you said, tell me about Princess Leia without naming the metal bikini, you know, there's all kinds of things you can say about her that make up her character. I couldn't begin to do that with Christina Ricci in this movie. That's a problem. And again, I think no one cares because everyone's focused on Johnny Depp falling all over the place. You know, or they're focused on the Headless Horseman stuff, which I had to laugh, by the way, because the scene where it's the kids in town fucking with Ichabod and they send, you know, and they chase after him. And I'm just like, oh, my God, that's the fakest looking thing ever. I hope that's not the whole movie. And then I realize, oh, it's them fucking with him. I'm like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, thank Christ.
Well done. My only other issue with this movie, because, again, a lot of it's really, really good. And I don't want to necessarily belabor the point by trying to pick at things unnecessarily. My biggest criticisms were an overuse of the same gag that made it ineffective, Christina Ricci's characterization, and finally, poor Christopher Walken. I mean, those flashback scenes of him as the Hessian, and then at the end, like, I would fire my agent. Like, I... And Tim Burton isn't George Lucas. He seems to know how people work. And I don't think he's an incompetent director in terms of eliciting performance. I mean, clearly he got a great performance out of Michael Keaton and Winona Ryder. He gets great performances out of his hetero life mate, Johnny Depp. He's not incompetent when it comes to drawing out performances from people. I don't know what the hell he told Christopher Walken. Or was Christopher Walken sniffing glue that day when they had him on set? I don't understand what's happening here. He's like, they gave him pointy teeth, and then he went, okay, you're this badass swordsman just killing motherfuckers left and right, and go. And Christopher Walken went, ooga booga, you know, and just kept doing it over and over again. And like, I start to think about Tim Burton as a person, and as he's watching Dale, and he's just like, oh, I love this. It's so over the top, crazy, and silly. And it reminds me of a thing I liked once when I was a child. And I'm like, is anyone going to tell him it sucks? This movie draws you into this world. There's a lot of great world building right at the top of it. There's a lot of time spent getting to know these characters. I was very involved in this movie. I was very drawn in, as was my daughter. And then they go to Christopher Walken, and I immediately forgot where I was. And I was like, and I went back to, oh, I'm watching a silly Tim Burton movie. Like, again, my daughter and I cracking up laughing at Christopher Walken. My wife wasn't even watching the movie. But at one point, she starts to hear, rawr, rawr, and she kind of walks over. She's like, is that Christopher Walken? It's like, is this a parody? That's how bad it is. And again, you can forgive it because it's only two or three scenes, and there's so much more to the movie than that. And everyone just kind of goes, ha ha, at Christopher Walken. And then we're back into a really good movie again. But it's such a tonal shift. And think about, if you want an example of what it should have looked like as opposed to what it was, Sauron in the beginning of Fellowship of the Ring. Sauron is a mute but menacing character. There's a reason why in a lot of these podcasts I go to Lord of the Rings as an example of near perfect filmmaking. Peter Jackson, look, we did it on trial for his King Kong. He ain't perfect, but Lord of the Rings damn near is. And if you want to present a mute menace of a fantasy warrior character, look no further than Sauron at the onset of the Fellowship of the Ring. He's incredible and scary as shit. You want a less good version, but still really, really good? Darth Vader. When Darth Vader walks onto the rebel ship, and my favorite one is Rogue One, which has been described as slash fiction for Star Wars fans, where he just looks in and just wrecks everybody. But it's a great scene because, again, I love Rogue One to death, but Darth Vader just murdering bitches as he walks onto the rebel ship might be both the most horrifying and funniest thing I've ever seen. And both of those I would have taken versus Christopher Walken's performance in this. And I can't blame Christopher Walken. I've seen him act. I've seen The Deer Hunter. He's great. I don't know what the hell he was going for here and why he was allowed to do it. Like, I don't know if Tim Burton was like, I love it, this reminds me of a thing I once liked, or if it was, we've done this 20 times, this isn't getting any better, we have to move on. I don't know which one it was, but it was unacceptable. Go ahead.
I think, honestly, it's Tim liked working with him so much on Batman Returns, he wanted to work with him on this. I couldn't find any substantial evidence that, you know, he was busy or he couldn't play one of the bigger roles. I did find in the, because I went back and I watched the special features on the DVD I have. And the reason that he screamed is that there were originally lines. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, Walken couldn't get past his New York accent. And he didn't want the horseman, I'm going to chop off your head. You fuck. You know, that does that. That's, you know.
Then dub him. That was I'm sorry. If I'm watching dailies of that performance, we're reshooting those scenes, or we're taking out the rawr, rawr, like a dungeon dragon. Like, honestly, I was waiting for him to bust into fucking, you know, Busta Rhymes.
Rawr, 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 thriller, like a dungeon. Thriller night. And no one's gonna save you from the horse.
I'll tell you what. It would have been more believable had the Headless Horseman busted into Scenario by A Tribe Called Quest.
definitely right. Been the most unforgettable Tim Burton movie. I say, do you remember when when fucking Christopher Walken just busted it?
Yeah, that's as far as prosecuting arguments go. I would allege that Sleepy Hollow is mostly a perfectly good, entertaining movie. I think it accomplishes what Tim Burton set out to do, but it has a little too many of the Burton-y self-indulgences that rub me the wrong way. And I will tell you, most people overlook it because they just love him so, and he speaks to them, you know, in a way that most directors don't. But I am not so easily swayed by something that appeals to my personal sensibilities. I look at it objectively and go, nope, you're not touching the ball in certain instances here. You're striking out, pal. This needed a little more collaboration, a little more work.
And in many points I will agree. I will say again, I will agree that Christopher Walken, what was happening. Again, I get a laugh out of it, so I mean, it really doesn't bug me.
My last note, and then I'm gonna full on let you do your defense. I understand this was probably what they were going for, but this is a personal thing. I didn't love how washed out this movie was. I mean, it's not quite Polar Bear in a Snowstorm, but it's a little washed out. Almost like they were using like a filter on the camera. It's a little too black and white for what is not supposed to be a black and white movie. I mean, Johnny Depp is not a ghost, but he could not be more pale for some strange reason. I don't know why. Like, I understand we're in powdered wig society, but this went to Casper the Friendly Ghost territory. And
also starring Christina Ricci.
Yeah, it all comes together.
6 degrees of Ricci.
Yes. You talk about escapism. If I'm reminded I'm watching a movie, I'm not escaping. There are elements of this movie that are definitely, it's aware it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that sometimes that works, and sometimes it's a little frustrating. Now the prosecution will turn it over to you.
The prosecution rests.
I'm not resting, pal. I'm waiting for my chance. I got last licks, pal.
That's true, because you're also the judge. I'll start with the coloring of it. I will agree that it is very washed out, but I think that was a choice, a stylistic choice. Burton, before anything else, is an artist. For those of you who don't know, he started off working at Disney. He did a few shorts, including one called Vincent's that was actually narrated by Vincent Price, which is fantastic. It's very well done. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's only about 5 minutes long. It's available on YouTube, so it's not hard to find. If you have the special edition of The Nightmare Before Christmas, it's also on there, on the third disc. But I believe it was a stylistic choice of, again, going back to Hammer, but also just how great horror films of him growing up. And again, I'm not basing my entire defense on, hey, well, he really liked this thing as a kid, because there was shit I liked as a kid that, again, I wouldn't put in my films. But I think for this one, with how trash the original story was and how little there was to it, this had to be style and as much substance as they could do. I think that the mystery is handled very well in this. I think the villain, Miranda Richardson, by the way, spoilers, is the villain at the end. And there is a reason that she's doing all this. And as much as it's not a earth-shattering plot of, like, I will take over the world, of course, you know, M. Bison kind of shit, it is enough of a personal revenge. Oof,
that's a reference.
Right.
Right, go ahead. Sauron, Darth Vader, M. Bison?
M. Bison. I mean, Raul Julia, man. Who's more intimidating than that? But I think the stylistic choice was, again, is Burton is a very visual director, and all of his films you can take screenshots of, and they, for the most part, look beautiful, and they look very much like works of art that you'd hang on your wall. Whereas that does not excuse certain things, and I will agree, Christina Ricci's character is very underdeveloped. But for the mystery of what it is, it is very well put together. The acting is on point. I mean, except for Walken, which, again, when I meet Tim Burton, trust me, Mr. Radlich, I will go. Before we go any further, I got my boy on the phone here. I need you to explain to me what the fuck was happening with Christopher Walken in Sleepy Hollow. We were sniffing glue. Mark, you were right. love you, man. Click. Moving on. Let's go make a movie. But overall, it is an extremely entertaining movie. It is a fun, like I said, it is escapism. But yes, there are moments that bring you into watching a film. But here's one of the things that changes it, is that you and I are incorrectly placed in certain ways to judge this, because we do film analysis. You know, you've been a film lover since, I'm assuming, you were a small child. So have I. I'm a film student. Our we enjoy films more when we can pick them apart. Even if, again, you were talking about Lord of the Rings being beautiful. There, and it is. It is. It's near perfect filmmaking. But there's stuff in there that you can pick apart too, you know, and you can poke and bitch at. This movie was not made, in my opinion, to try to gain any awards. It was made by a director who very much loved the aesthetic, very much wanted to tell a fun mystery gothic story, and at the same time be able to homage and write a love letter to something he loved as a child. And it succeeds in every point. It is goofy. It is campy. But find a Tim Burton movie that's not campy. It's an argument that I make a lot of times with other horror movies, like, wow, this was really violent. I'm like, it's called A Nightmare on Elm Street, not My Little Pony Friendship is Magic. Now, if Rainbow Dash comes out...
We're an angry mob, sorry. Go ahead.
What? Halloween ends, hashtag rah-rah, we're an angry mob. Yes. But again, it's like, you know, again, if My Little Pony comes out with Rainbow Dash with a fork in her hoof, you know, I'm still going to watch it to find out where they're going. But again, it's two very different things. This is where, and I've spoken about it on the podcast about this before, is that there are movies like, actually the poster that sits above my head right now, Alien, which is just, it is fine. If you break down movies into food, it is fine dining. It is filet mignon. It is, you know, find the fanciest dish you can. That's what it is. You also have movies like Friday the 13th, which is macaroni and cheese, pizza, and mashed potatoes. It's probably not good for you, but it'll fill you up and it's fine. Sleepy Hollow rests in a very middle ground where it is not prime. No. I see you and no.
Sorry, if the rule, Dorian, as you know, is that if you're going to respond to the thing on screen, you have to read the thing on screen.
Shay Wall has commented in. Sorry, I actually did not know that rule. I still need that handbook. The Cupcakes Creepy Pasta would like to join this chat. And for those of you who just joined us, they're saying that because I mentioned My Little Pony with Rainbow Dash with a fork and a hoof coming at the other characters. But Sleepy Hollow rests in this beautiful kind of cradle that it is not filet mignon, but it's also not trash either. It's well made. It's well acted. It's fun. Yes, Christina Ricci doesn't have much character other than blonde and in danger. But for this movie, I don't think that she really needed to. That wasn't the point. The point of this movie, to be honest, is the story of Ichabod Crane. And he does have a really great character arc, and the fainting is part of it. In every other film, especially if we're trying to preach a message or something like that, the character will start one way, and then by the end, they are changed, and they are stronger, and they go off into the world. That's not what Tim was wanting to do with this. Tim was wanting to get a character who was squeamish and cowardly, but was brilliant. And in situations like this, where it's like the head was missing, it's been seared off, it's cauterized. That's one of the things, is that when they're examining the body and it's got, you know, no head, which, by the way, very quickly, the makeup on this, especially the dead bodies with the decapitated head, is on point. It's beautiful. It's not ultra realistic, but it is visually stunning. But so Ichabod has to deal with the fact that though he is a coward, he has to overcome that. And even more than that, he has to really go back and become a broader minded person. There is a whole subplot of his mother being a witch, or he says child of the forest, I believe, is the exact line. And his mom's obviously Wiccan, and she shows spells and stuff like that. His father was a, you know, hellfire and brimstone, you know, looks like, you know, Protestant minister from that time, you know, mid 1700s ish, and who kills his mom by sticking her in a Iron Maiden, which I thought was hilarious because my favorite Batman film is Batman Returns, which Bruce Wayne uses as a thing to the Batcave. He steps into this Iron Maiden, the spikes go back, it closes, and it shoots him down this slide, which I was all like, right. I'm getting one of those when I'm older. But so
one of my favorite lines from Bill and Ted, put them in the Iron Maiden. Excellent. Execute them. Bogus. What?
But so Ichabod is very, it's obvious that his mother died at a young age. We see that, and that his father tried to beat religion into him. So instead of going with either the very stuffy religion or the beauty of like kind of the Wiccan They never nailed down what it is. So if it's not Wiccan, I apologize if I'm insulting anyone. But instead of going with either, he goes down the middle path of just science. This is it. This shit doesn't exist. This shit doesn't exist. And his character arc in interacting with Katrina, who is a witch of herself, but more of a white witch, and dealing with all this supernatural stuff, is that he regains some of that beauty of the magic his mother showed to him. And that to me is his character arc. This is his story. Katrina does need to be more than just a love interest, because even at the end, those of you old musical fans, there's a line when they're exiting the coach and Johnny Depp's sidekick, his Robin, if you will, in this film is a character named Young Masbeth. And I do not remember the actor's name, but he's kind of the more straight man to Johnny Depp's, you know, fainting fop. There's a really wonderful moment where Depp has got his courage up and he knows what he's going to do. He's like, I will be going into the Western Woods. Who will come with me? And all the other town leaders look at each other like, you're fucking crazy. And it cuts to the kid going, me? like, I'm it, I guess. But so at the end, obviously, the Headless Horseman is given his head back. Miranda Richardson is dragged into the tree hell. The tree that actually you see behind me is a portal to hell that allows the horseman to go back and forth. She's drugged into that. Ichabod faints again. Which I thought was a really nice touch. It was like, even after all this, you know, he's jumping off carriages, lighting windmills on fire, you know, running his head off. It's like, there's still that beautiful coward underneath. And he's just a squeamish guy. And God, we got to love him. But anyways, coming back to the old musical fans thing, the very end of the movie, they're exiting coach. They're in New York. It's snowing. You can bear that very much Burton black and white motif, you know. And, Depp is walking with Ricci, and he turns to Masbeth, who's walking behind them, and he goes, don't worry, young Masbeth, you'll soon get your bearings. The Bronx is up and the battery's down, and home is that way, which is a very famous line from a song from
New York, New York.
New York, New York from On the Town.
Yes.
Almost said Singing in the Rain. I'm like, right actor, wrong movie. But no, to sum it up, this is a fun Halloween. Well, any time of year movie, you know, for me, every day is Halloween. But if, you know, you're looking for a fun gothic mystery that's going to give you everything it tells you it's going to, doesn't promise more than it delivers, this is your movie. It is beautifully stunning. It is acted fantastically. It is costumed. The great Colleen Atwood, once again, working with Burton and just cracking her knuckles and letting everything fly. The horror and suspense is done beautifully without relying on too many jump scares. I think if I recall correctly, there's a grand total of 3 in the entire film.
Yeah, it wasn't many that I could count.
And the special effects keep it campy enough that you can let's say you're not a huge horror fan, and I know a lot of my friends. In fact, my mentor, my sensei, who I think is watching right now. Hi, Sensei, is not a huge horror fan, but he enjoys this film because, again, the campiness of it allows it to be more accessible to a regular audience that doesn't like horror, as opposed to something like Nightmare on Elm Street.
The police is the jury. I would like to enter into evidence 2 things. The first is the movie Gung Ho. And I reference Gung Ho. No one remembers this movie except me. So Gung Ho is about an auto plant that is taken over by the Japanese, and
Michael Keaton,
yeah, and sorry, George Wendt from Cheers. Maybe I can make a sitcom out of this. Did not have Michael Keaton in it. Anyway, in the movie, the Japanese set a really high quota for the amount of cars that they have to build. And everyone freaks the fuck out. You know, these are union workers. It's a story about a clash of cultures between the high intensity, high work Japanese culture and the Pabst Blue Ribbon blue collar workers of America. Therein lies the dramatic tension, especially at a time where we were having a lot of struggles with Japanese culture in this country. You know, and then they gave us anime and they won the war. Anyway, but
what's the line from Die Hard? Pearl Harbor didn't work out, so we got you with tape decks.
Yes, that's about right. But the line, the bit that I always reference is, and it speaks to settling for less, is when everyone freaks out about the high Japanese quota, Michael Keaton lies, and to kind of keep the peace and keep them working, and he'll figure it out later, he'll fix it in post, is, oh, well, there's a medium quota. And George Wendt, speaking on behalf of the trees, says, okay, well, then we'll just do that one. And Michael Keaton's like, fuck. Like, that's, there is no medium quota. What am I going to do? And it's a great frustration I have with film for always wanting to settle for the medium quota. And I think if I'm going to name charges that we're prosecuting Tim Burton for, it's that his movies could be so much more if he pushed himself a little bit, if he were a little more story focused, if he were a little bit more theme focused. I think he could take these sort of junk food movies and keep the escapism, keep the fantasy elements, but make them more substantial. But instead, he kind of settles for a C, you know, C+. And his fans are like, well, I'm a C+ student. This speaks to me. I'm fine with it. I don't want more than this. And I'm sitting here going, you have the potential to be so much better. And that's my great frustration with this movie, is it comes across as self-satisfied with being great looking, but average in, for lack of a better word, intelligence. And there was potential for it to be more. Second thing I would like to enter into evidence. It's going to sound like a compliment. It's going to sound like it's an argument for the defense, but it's not. It's an argument for the prosecution. In the year of our Lord 2000, it was nominated for Academy Awards for Best Art Direction, Best Cinematography, and Best Costume Design. It won for Best Art Direction. You know what it didn't get nominated for? Screenplay. You know what it didn't get nominated for? Performances. Didn't get nominated or win for direction. Yes, it's a very nice looking. Sleepy Hollow is a sexy gal with not a lot to say. And if you're into the shallow, sexy gals, that's fine. No one's taking that away from you. God knows I am. But know what it is you're settling for. And let's be honest about that. And I think that's the last thing I want to say about this movie, is as a criticism, as somebody who is doing deep dive film analysis, I'm saying you can settle for a movie that says nothing and it's just, you know, 2 hours of a romping good time, but let's not then give it more than it deserves. Let's call the devil by its name. Let's say what it actually is. It's a fun-looking movie, but that's about it. It's a C. It's average. It is Tim Burton, as you said, as the defense said, writing a love letter to the thing he likes and hoping you'll like it too, and nothing more than that, and that's kind of a shame. Because I think there's more in there. I think there's more in him. But everyone just sort of settles, and it's frustrating, and it leaves me wanting. So I'll give you a chance to respond to that, but we can just chat a bit, and then we'll head towards plugs. What do you think, Dorian?
Gotcha. Yeah. My closing remarks for the jury is, you guys are audience members out there. Like all of us, we're consumers. And I tell you what, I'm just going to do it this way. In my film classes, I actually got to take a class that was taught by a very famous filmmaker. I've talked about him before on the show, but for those of you who know me, I hate name dropping because I think it's just it's a jump scare and it's the fart joke. It's cheap. But that guy said several things to me, several things to me, because I was the only one in the class, obviously. Said several things to the entire class. First and foremost being is make the movie that you want to see. as a creator, make the movie you want to see. Make, you know, you'll never be happy with your final product. And it's actually kind of brilliant that you brought it up in the way you did, because it segues really quickly in to it. Is this gentleman also said every film that has ever been made, mine, yours, and the future ones, can always be better, because hindsight will always be 20/20. But you have to remember not to try to look for that towards that hindsight. I'm like, what are they going to think 20 years from? What are they going to think 5 years from now? What are they going to think 6 months from now? Is make the story that you want to see. And make this movie that you, as the director, as the writer, you know, whatever, is going to enjoy and be as proud of as possible. You calling it a C, or the prosecution calling it a C, I have to disagree with. I would give it a solid B. And here's why. We talked about movies as food before. And I know I've done it on this podcast before. There are days that you don't want to go to a five-star restaurant. Even if you could afford it, you had money flowing out of your ears. The food's just too rich. It's too much to digest. Sometimes it's nice to go to, I'm trying to think of a better example than Applebee's, but because that's not the case. We were with him till he fucking said Applebee's.
Can I tell you for a second? So when my daughter turned 10, she had just started to develop a taste for steak, and we have a steakhouse here in Tampa called Charlie's. Mm-hmm. And it's a high-end steakhouse. It's a family style. When we took her for her birthday, and I said, for her birthday, I want to do something special. She just turned 10, double digits. And I said, I want to take you out for a fancy steak dinner. And we didn't go to the high end, because I'm not a millionaire. But I took her to Charlie's. I'd never been there before, and I thought this would be a fun family thing for her and a way to celebrate her 10th birthday. And it was like a $500 steak meal. So now my son's about to turn 10. He'll be 10 in April. And we said to him, hey, do you want to do like what your sister did? Do you want to have like a fancy meal? And, you know, is there a type of food that you would like to go to a fancy restaurant for to celebrate your 10th birthday? And he was like, yeah, I like seafood. Can we go to Red Lobster? Now, after I finished beating him to death, I said, no, Jonas, Red Lobster does not qualify as fancy. I'm going to stop myself there. We have a nice crowd of people watching tonight, so I'm going to keep the off-color jokes to myself.
My friends, forgive him. He knows not what he wants.
Oh, I know exactly what I'm doing, and I'm trying not to do it. But he went Red Lobster, and I'm like, what the fuck? Are you such and such? Like, what are you? No. So when you're sitting there like, okay, so what's a step down from fancy? Red Lobster.
It hit me, I was like, the first thing that popped in my head was Applebee's, and then I thought better of it. And I'm going to go with Smokehouse Barbecue.
Sure.
That is I don't know if they have them in Tampa. In the Midwest, it's a really nice barbecue place. It's not too fancy, but it's not, you know, throw your trash on the floor kind of a place. And it is always a solid B. You get what you're coming in for. Now, for the audience members out there that have a kid that's, you know, experimenting with goth, and this is a great film to show them. This is again, they'll love it. They'll have a lot of fun with it. If you're somebody who enjoys period pieces that aren't so stuck and rigid on, you know, the exact history, because this is very revisionist. We all know it. And it's fine. You know, and we walked in knowing it. It's an amazing film. If you're just looking for a fun, like if you're if you're a Tim Burton fan, you're going to love the movie. There's only like a few on his list that you wouldn't like. Cough, Cough, Planet of the Apes, Cough, Cough, Miss Peregrine's School for Interesting Children, cough, cough. And yes, comments, you can fight me on that one. But overall, this film is not going to make you walk away with anything deep or life-changing, but you will walk away remembering it. At the same point, it doesn't have any like lines like, you know, the prosecution brought up Lord of the Rings, so I'll use that. There's so many, you know, memorable lines in Lord of the Rings. Nobody tosses a dwarf. We will not abandon Merry and Pippin to torment and death. You shall not pass. This movie has a few lines that you'll remember, but overall you remember having a good time, and that's why the movie is a solid B. It is not a C. It is a great film. It did win some awards, but that for the audience, for you, the consumer, that's not what's important. You're going to have a great time. You're going to see some great actors, ones you saw go on to stuff or stuff people you'd seen before, having a really fun time with this dark, twisted tale that Tim Burton and Kevin Yeager and Andrew Scott took from a trash-ass short story and turned it into a fun gothic mystery that I believe can stand with the best of gothic films. And I think you will, too, if you go watch it. In fact, I know you will.
The fun about doing this particular podcast versus Damn You Hollywood or A Long Road to Ruin or Triple Feature is that whatever side you're on, it really forces you to hard pick a side. Because this was not an easy movie for me to criticize. Because essentially what I'm saying, essentially my whole argument was entirely founded on the concept of everything has to be high art. It has to be, and I'm not that guy, typically. I'm like, you know, like first, before we started tonight, I told you, I was like, I was the craft defender. I watch Roger Corman movies. I watch Soul Cinema, you know. Yeah, it's not like I only eat fruit from the freshest fruit from the finest of trees. I watch plenty of trash.
Well, that's why I didn't like jump you on it, because I was like, okay, he's doing this because he has to, because he's the prosecution. Yeah. Like, we're staring at each other across the desk going, I'm sorry, man. I don't want to be here. I'd be on your side going, yeah, I'm not going to burn it.
It's like, you know, it's like a guy like saves a bunch of kids from, you know, from a burning building and gets charged with trespass. Like, right. I'm right. I'm sorry. I have to prosecute you. It's my job. But, you know. But that's the fun of doing this, is that, you know, as I said to you, this is not a movie I would have highly criticized. I mean, like I said, when my daughter asked me what I thought of it, I said, oh, I had an issue with that. But other than that, like, it's great. You know, I had a fun time watching it. I'm not sorry we did this. Believe me, I've been exposed to far worse. But then I have to sit here and I go, okay, I really have to focus on what's wrong with this movie now. And I have to think about a coherent argument that I have to make to say why this movie doesn't work. And essentially my argument was, well, it's not high art. Shouldn't everything be high art?
You know? Very quickly, for everyone watching, please give yourselves at home, give Mr. Mark Radlich a huge hand, because that's not an easy, he got the hard job. I got the easy. Yeah, give yourself applause. That works. talking about Tim Burton being self-indulgent. Objection.
Are you kidding me?
So, Loki.
I could go on.
No, it's. I got the fun job. I got to be the ever young dreamer who's like, this is great stuff. I mean, it's not amazing. But no, you got the tough job on this. So next time, if there's an on trial that I can help for, I'll take the shit job.
Yeah, in the course of doing this for the last few years, I had to prosecute Training Day. You talk about a movie I reference a lot. In fact, Robert asked me, he was like, what is your high watermark for overacting? And I went, Denzel Washington in Training Day.
King Kong ain't got shit on me.
I have been known to say Denzel Washington spends that entire movie smacking his dick into the scenery.
Right. He's not showing it. He's trying to make love to it.
I was going to say, yeah, he is sexually assaulting the scenery and everything that gets in his way. But that was the thing. Like, Training Day got nominated for an Oscar. And in fact, I think it won for Denzel Washington won for an Oscar, but it was more like a Lifetime Achievement Award. And I remember, like, I can't remember why we picked it, but I had to come up with an argument for why this, you know, Oscar winning movie wasn't good. And yeah, and it, what I like about doing this podcast is it makes me stretch as a debate, as somebody who debates the merit of film. So it was fun. I'm glad we did this. I told you earlier, I want to have you back on for a triple feature on Tim Burton. You know, Edward Scissorhands, Mars Attacks, and I don't know, something else. I'll let you pick the third one. Because I think it would be fun. I think it would be fun to examine him more. I think as I was listening to myself talk and listening to you, I think my issue with this movie and my issue with Tim Burton is the fans of Tim Burton. It's kind of like, you know, like there's this band, not my favorite band, but I don't hate them either, but I hate their fans. My God, it's look, this isn't a good example because like I love the band, but like Hatebreed, okay? Hatebreed is fantastic. Like, you want to talk about like an overly positive, just wonderfully wonderful messages, you know, great music, you know, it's heavy, but it's positive. And their fans across the board, douchebags, just awful. Like, I did an entire rant on Hatebreed fans, the last two Metal Hammer of Dooms, about how like Hatebreed just brings out the meatheads. And like, it's kind of what this is. It's like, I know he didn't direct it, but he produced it, like A Nightmare Before Christmas. It's one of those where it's like, my cousin said to me once,
episode one.
You beat me to it. So I'm nigh on 50 years old, and I have a cousin who I think is in her 30s now. So we're about 10-ish years apart. And if you think I'm a snob now, you should have seen what kind of a gatekeeper I was in my 20s, which puts her in like elementary school, early junior high. And she's, and you know, and of course, again, I grew up in like the goth industrial scene. And I remember we're having a conversation. She's like, I'm goth. And I'm like, sure you are, Rachel. And she's like, no, I am. And I'm like, okay, well, what do you listen to? She's like, Korn and Rob Zombie. And then I punched her in the face, because what are you supposed to do when someone tells you that? Now, years later, she would start talking to me about, like, I think it was like the Electric Hellfire Club and Alien Sex Fiend. She named it another band. And I was like, oh, you're getting better. You know, at least those are somewhat in that genre. But yeah, you know, Korn, what the fuck is wrong with you? Anyway, I think that's my problem with Tim Burton, is that it becomes kind of goth for dummies. And it's like, ugh. Well, and I kind of hate that about myself, because I don't want to always be the snobby gatekeeper person. But then I gotta sit here and listen to like half an idiot tell me about how goth she is because she likes A Nightmare Before Christmas. And I'm just like, shut up.
And I will agree. There is a strong group of the Tim Burton fans that have become extra bitches. And it doesn't matter what your gender is.
What do you call them? Hot Topic goth? That's about right.
Well, again, y'all also very, very. I'm not going to go into full. We could do a whole podcast on the history of Hot Topic. Is that how there was a Pepperidge Farm remembers when there was a time.
South Park. South Park still remains the greatest satire in modern television. Burn down the Hot Topic.
But yeah, there was a time the Hot Topic was very, very goth. It was still, you know, the industrial, mm-hmm. the trip pants, stuff like that. No, those were great days, and it has become more commercial, much like everything else, including Tim Burton. You know, if you look at some of his later films, he did fall. There are a lot of fans that have become, like I said, extra bitches, despite, and you know, no, doesn't matter what gender they are. But Tim Burton is also, movie wise, a very good gateway to like, do I like goth stuff? Let's watch some Tim Burton films, see how you walk away from it. You know, and then you can take them back and, you know, show them, you know, the old Dark House, Rebecca, you know, some of those great, you know, The Haunting, the 1963 Haunting, by the way, none of that 99 bullshit with Liam Neeson. I'm just saying. Sorry, it's very deep. Hey, if anybody wants to prosecute that on this show, let me know. I will prosecute that to hell. Yes, Shay, we know. Shay Wall chimes in and says, A Nightmare Before Christmas, one of the few kids' movies I watched, and I thought my childhood was weird.
Hey, it's one of the ones that my kids and I did a commentary track for, because my son needed to have an on-air debate over whether or not it was a Christmas or Halloween movie.
It's both.
I don't want to hear it. I don't even care anymore. Between that and Die Hard, I'm so sick of people and their stupid debates. He said on the debate podcast.
Christmas doesn't start till I see Hans Gruber fall from the Nakatomi building.
That's right. All right. Anything else about this movie that you want to talk about before we get out of here?
No, again, I just say, hey, you know, horror fan or not, give it a chance. I mean, if you're a horror fan and just maybe it passed you by, you know what? I'll just say it this way, so we're not dragging this out. Go give it a watch. If you hate it, come back to the comments here and tell me I'm a bleeping idiot. Actually, I've cussed enough during this thing. Tell me I'm a fucking idiot. I will find. I will have Mark or someone show me the comment. I will personally respond to you. It's fine. I totally understand. But because again, all movies aren't for everybody. In fact, Alexis, who's another big, big part of this, channel, she hosts a couple of shows of herself, is a huge Shining fan. She and I are friends, and maybe this could be a special on trial. She absolutely loves Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. I detest
it. We've already done that one.
Oh, darn. Sorry, Alexis. Better luck next time.
I'm going to need you to go through the entire 10-year history of the Rattlesnake Broadcasting Network and write down everything I've ever done so that you stop pitching me shows I've already done, Evan Bevins.
Somebody needs to, we need a secretary. Like, take, I'll go back and I'll watch them, and I'll just archive everything so we can be like, can we do that? Yep, yep, right there. Can't do that one. But no, give the movie a watch. It is a lot of fun. It has some campy moments. It has some very, very terrifying moments. And again, it's beautiful. And again, if you like gothic stuff at all, even if you're not a goth, it's a great film.
Agreed. Look, if I wasn't doing this podcast where it was a debate format, I would have handled it a little bit differently. But I think overall, it's a worthy watch. It was a fun 2 hours of my time. And it's, I don't know if I'll ever watch it again, but if it's on and, you know, if my daughter ever comes back and says, hey, remember that time we watched Sleepy Hollow? You know, we should do that again. Sure. This is not one that would pain me to watch a second time. All right, folks, that is our on trial for Sleepy Hollow. Dorian, this was great. You're allowed to pitch me more stuff, just not shit I've already done. Okay,
I'll do my best. I'll get a list.
Yeah,
I'll find something really weird next time.
Sounds great. This past week we did a review of The Hunger Games: The Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes. Which, if you are interested in what Sean and I thought about The Hunger Games previously with Jennifer Lawrence, those are in the archives as well. We did a 2-part Long Road to Ruin on those. And then myself and Robert Winfrey spent almost 2.5 hours talking about this new Hunger Games movie and about the necessity of prequels and what makes a good prequel versus a bad one, lies in marketing and, you know, falsehoods in trailers. So it was a good show, one of the better ones we've done as of late. We didn't spend 2 hours beating the shit out of Marvel movies, so it's very different for us. This morning, this Thanksgiving Day, we re-aired our Limp Bizkit Greatest Hits Metal Hammer of Doom. That was a fun one. That was one of our turkey shows. This Saturday, we've got a re-airing of the WWE Halftime Heat alternative commentary that we did. It was an NXT show, 6-man tag. And then Metal Hammer of Doom Sunday's return with Clutch, Psychic Warfare. This week on the Rattle Legend Broadcasting Network, we've got a loaded week of shows. Like, I've only really been doing 2 a week, maybe 3 if I'm feeling froggy and I've got the time. But this week, we are wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, got something going on every day and twice on Sundays. Well, we kick off Monday with Damn You Hollywood, the new Disney animated feature, Wish. It'll be myself, Alexis Haina, Robert Winfrey, and good boy, Zachary Strobel. And then this will be the third or last opportunity to do this, because if he doesn't show up for this show, I'm not doing this anymore. Myself and Jason Teasley, speaking of Long Road to Ruins, will be doing Lake Placid, all 4 ridiculous movies. Alexis Haina will push me into the pool, and she will be reviewing Thanksgiving with Dorian Price, as you see before, and Jason Teasley. And then I've got a double shot of shows, 2 TV parties, 1 in the daytime with Alexis Haina. We'll be reviewing Upload Season 3. And then it's a little late, but, you know, it's when we could get it done. It's our annual Veterans Day show. And this year we are looking at The Pacific, myself and Andrew Graham. That's all for me. Thanks. I'm driving. Dorian Price, show us where you piss from.
Well, again, as you see right down here, it's Frikey Pictures. That's on Twitter. That's on Instagram. That's on Facebook and TikTok. If you need photography, videography for anything, family photos, special events, small commercial for a small business you're starting. Our motto is, if it needs to be filmed or photographed, give us a call. We can make it happen. Ms. Ratledge said, I will see all of you next... Shit.
Wednesday.
Where is it?
Wednesday.
For the Thanksgiving review. It's on my calendar that I'm not staring at right now. But yeah, so always excited to be on here. Hopefully we'll be able to get on that triple feature. Tim Burton, maybe after the start of the year. Hope everyone's having a fantastic Thanksgiving. hope it's been drama free and you haven't that you're watching this and not burying a family member in the back 40. But yeah, that's all for me. Go watch Sleepy Hollow. In fact, I'm going to sign off here and go watch it now again.
Sounds great. All right. I am at Mark Rattledge on X. But more importantly, I am at Mark Rattledge on TikTok. You can hear my son do a tight 3 minutes on gourmet popcorn or on, you know, where do we get alcohol from? My son, budding comedian. You can also hear me do naked karaoke or clothed karaoke, whichever I happen to be doing on that particular day. But more importantly, 10-minute clips of any, including this one, 10-minute clips of any of the podcasts that I do, they're all up on my TikTok, at Mark Rattledge. For Dorian Price, this has been On Trial. Be well, be safe, and behave.